This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services, and your number is 877-217-5757. We start with Whitney Dawn Brough. She was with us a year ago, and at the age of 32, faced a diagnosis of breast cancer that came out of nowhere. And Whitney, for those of us who have followed her through the years, is a superstar. She was Miss Teen Louisiana when she was a teenager.
A little while ago.
And then Baton Rouge High, and graduate of the Manship School at LSU, MBA in the last 10 years. She has been and continues to work in high levels for Eli Lilly, is the largest pharmaceutical, one of them.
Definitely one of the top five.
And you do international work, right?
I do. I do a lot of global marketing work, and that's my passion, certainly, is working outside of the U.S.
And you just got a big promotion the exact day you were diagnosed with breast cancer.
Yep, March 20th, 2020. Bought a home that day, got promoted at work, and a little later that afternoon got a call that said, you know, life's going to look a little different than maybe what I anticipated, but it's been an incredible journey, and I've learned so much.
What did they tell you when they called you on the 20th day of March last year?
You know, the doctor called, and you could hear it kind of in his voice. He cut right to the chase, and it was, you know, Whitney, it's cancer.
Did they give you a stage?
Not at that time. We didn't know how bad it was. It took about another 2 weeks or so in order to do PET scans and MRIs in order to fully understand how progressive it was. And so after we did all of the scans, they diagnosed me as like a late stage 3B breast cancer. So pretty much metastatic disease. Yeah.
So extremely dangerous.
Yes.
At 32 years old.
At 32.
And no health problems preceding this.
No, I was doing a lot of working out so LSU could win a national championship. I was closing all the circles on my Apple Watch.
Well, yeah, LSU had just won the national
title.
They did.
I was there. It was an amazing experience. I mean, living life on top of the world, and then a global pandemic hits all of us, and then a cancer diagnosis.
Yeah, that was the week that John Bel Edwards issued the stay-at-home order on the 16th, which was a Monday, so I guess the 20th was a Friday. What a way to end the week.
I found the lumps in my chest on Friday the 13th, the day the kids got sent home, and we didn't know when they would go back to school. But it was that day.
So you did just a routine exam of yourself.
I didn't. It was a random happened chance that we found it, that I found it that day. Had never performed a self-breast exam, not even crossed my mind as something that I needed to do with any type of frequency.
But you have handled this like a champ, no doubt about it. And what a shock. And somebody who's accustomed to success, and now you were facing, and still are, as we all do, something beyond your control to a large extent.
Indeed, yeah. It was, you know, I have a tremendous fear of a failure, probably. Like just like people are afraid of heights, I fear failure just the same. Like it inhibits my ability to even function sometimes. And so for my health to be the thing that I failed at or felt like I failed at, that was a really big wake up for me. But it also provided me with the opportunity to learn more about myself, learn more about this disease and how it impacts our community. And I feel really blessed and maybe even called to spread awareness about it because of it.
877-217-5757 for Whitney Brough, who now, by the way, is on the board of Women's Hospital.
I am. I am very excited to be a part of such a dynamic organization like Women's Hospital. The Breast and GYN Cancer Pavilion, which is a partnership with Women's Hospital, Mary Bird Perkins, and Our Lady of the Lake, has literally saved my life. I mean, in the midst of a global pandemic, I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and so the staff and the nurse navigators and the nurses and the infusion specialists, I never had a family member sit next to me during chemotherapy. I had to do all of that on my own. So I'm really lucky to be in a position to give back to the organization, to Women's Hospital, and to not only serve as a voice for patients, but also to bring my experience in the healthcare industry as well.
You did radiation and chemo, right?
I did both.
Yeah. How did that affect you?
It, you know, chemo was hard. And it was 6 rounds, you did 1 round every 3 weeks. But I'll tell you, radiation was worse. And I think there's a real common misconception about, you know, you see people ring the bell and you assume that whatever it is that they're going through is over. And there's a lot more that goes into a cancer journey and a cancer treatment for a patient. And I think it's so important that we understand that. But radiation is that one's really intense.
Well, when you got that phone call that nobody wants to receive, when you hung up the phone, what was it like?
Oh, I broke down. I broke down. And I don't cry very often. But that was a moment that I just kind of completely lost it. But it, because it, how do you respond to that? I'm very accustomed, as you mentioned, I'm very used to, if I see a challenge or a problem, I just find a way to get things done. And I think that's become my brand a bit. And in this case, there was nothing that I could do in that moment to fix what was happening. I had to go through the process.
And you have a young son.
I do. I'll be 13. He'll be 13 next month.
How did he accept it?
You know, he is a Jason, my boy. He is a special kid, and I'm so proud to be his mom. And he's demonstrated why I'm proud to be his mom throughout this experience. And he's got a gift. He's got a gift. I really believe that he's going to be a part of changing our community and being a part of our solution. I see a bright future for him ahead.
877-217-5757 for breast cancer survivor Whitney Bro. She's had surgery since we last saw her. We'll talk about that as well. But Q on Airline, I know, has been waiting for just a bit. Q, you're on with Whitney. Good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning. Hi, Whitney.
Good morning.
Yvonda.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm so happy to hear you. I heard this morning that your name, and I just screamed in my car. And I wanted to say hi. I've been following your stories, of course, on Facebook and everything, and I'm just so excited for you, and I'm so inspired by your story and how strong you are.
Oh, my friend, I appreciate you. You know, we learned it tough at dear old Baton Rouge High.
We did.
It prepared us for life. But I appreciate your support and your prayers and your thoughts. And it means a lot. It means a lot to have the support of friends like you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Q. And we talked last week. Dr. Michael Castine, 1 out of 8 women will get a breast cancer diagnosis. And in Louisiana, because of lifestyle, we probably have a higher rate. Now, Whitney is one of those people who didn't have any lifestyle issues at all. She's in fabulous condition, young, and no health problems, no family history.
No family history. 85% of women that are diagnosed with breast cancer have no family history of the disease. And I certainly fell into that category. And you talk about the 1 in 8, Jim, and I think about what we've gone through as a world in the last year and a half. Mm-hmm. We are anticipating an increase in cancer diagnosis, breast cancer diagnosis, as we get into 2022, because women have not made it to those routine appointments. They haven't had that annual mammogram. We're anticipating an increase in diagnosis. It's truly a screening crisis. Probably about a 10% increase in deaths as well, due to just not having those routine exams happen due to the COVID pandemic. And so it's so important for women to schedule those annual exams and to continue to perform self-breast exams in order to detect any abnormalities.
And in July, as in just 3 months ago, you had another surgery.
I did, reconstructive surgery. For every breast cancer survivor out there, we all know how awesome that one is. but it certainly helped to set me back into a place where I'm feeling normal again. And normal is something that I think at 33, you want more than anything, and you don't want any decision that you're making to be definite. And in my case, some of the decisions that I've had to make, I mean, my hair may be growing back after I shaved it, but to remove both of my breasts off my chest, that was a decision that I could never get back. But it was what I had to do to save my life.
Yeah, when you wake up and suddenly something is gone.
Oh, yeah.
That's another moment where I'm sure there were some tears.
Oh yeah. They caught me in the hallway, almost about to break down. But, you know, like I said, there's an incredible staff at Women's Hospital that surrounds women like myself and provides support in some of the most difficult moments.
You're now an ambassador, and you know, quite possibly you'll live another 60, maybe 70 years. So you got a long time to to spread the word, but you live with this. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there are recurrences. Does mm-hmm. that give you pause?
It does. And I think as I've kind of gone through this experience, one of the things that I'm really adamant about this October, this year, is talking about what happens after mm-hmm. the diagnosis, after the treatment. Because if you know a breast cancer survivor, or as I like to say, a thriver, the experience is not over for us because the treatments have maybe ended. There is this fear of recurrence that exists in many of our minds. I was talking to a breast cancer thriver in Indianapolis last week, and we were saying how, you know, we wake up every day mm-hmm. wondering, is this going to be the day that it comes back? And that's a fear. That's a real tangible fear that we have, that we have to work through each and every day.
877-217-5757, your Talk Louisiana number. Send emails to talk@talklouisiana.org. Alondra Villarreal is producing, and we're back with Whitney in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757. Whitney Dawn Brough is with us. She is a breast cancer thriver and a high-ranking executive with Eli Lilly. And on March 20th of last year, she was diagnosed with breast cancer, stage 3, and she underwent the double mastectomy, and then in July, reconstruction. And last week, we had Michael Castine, Dr. Castine, on. He said a lot of women now are opting for having the works. Mm-hmm. Did you think about that, or did they advise against it?
The works, I got it all done.
But I mean, doing it, the removal and the reconstruction simultaneously.
Well, and I had to wait. So I had to go through the radiation process. So you had to do the double mastectomy after chemo and then radiation. And then after 6 months after radiation, you could do reconstructive surgery. And I've got amazing physicians.
There are some good doctors of all kinds in Indeed. Baton Rouge. But for a city of our size, it's kind of like for a city of our size, I think we have more Lebanese restaurants per capita than any city in America. And we have a lot of cosmetic surgeons out there. And I suspect you're very pleased with your
I am. Dr. Jenna results. Bourgeois is absolutely fantastic. Dr. Lauren Zatarain, who's been my oncologist. Cecilia Koontz, who's been my breast surgeon. It's an incredible team. And Baton Rouge is very lucky mm-hmm. that we have such knowledgeable and expertise and innovative options right here locally. You don't have to go down. You don't have to go to MD Anderson in Houston. You've got options right here.
You've been with Eli Lilly for 10 years.
10 years, yeah.
And you worked it out where you were going to live, as you do, in Baton Rouge and work for them, and they're in Indianapolis. And I suspect, based on the fact that you're with them continuing and celebrated your 10-year anniversary, they must have treated you well.
They did. They're very good to me, very supportive. Eli Lilly, we have an oncology division in our business unit. So even when I was diagnosed, the global medical advisor for our breast cancer treatment actually was a part of the treatment team, got on the phone with my doctors, had conversations. They've been extremely good to me. They provided me with opportunities that a little girl from Louisiana, mm-hmm. you know, could have never dreamed of. I've been to almost 32 countries now. And the opportunity to work with people from around the world has really helped me to develop as a professional. But also, I kind of share my love for Louisiana yeah. everywhere I go. Let me tell you, everybody in Lilly around the world knows when LSU football season is here, Whitney is your girl if you want to talk football.
Yeah, I saw Whitney at the Rose Bowl. You follow the Tigers, right?
I do. I move around. I make sure that I get to all the good games.
It's been a tough year. Now, before the show, Alondra Villarreal, our producer, said she wants LSU to hire Joe Brady as its next coach. And who do you have a favorite?
I do have a favorite. I'm going to go with, I'm on the Lane train. I'm riding with Lane Kiffin. I want the offensive firepower that he could bring. I think we could recruit some exceptional quarterbacks and become known as a team. Look at the wide receivers that we have. Mm-hmm. There's just so many options that we have and talent that's coming up through the state. And I would love to see LSU get back on the winning streak.
Well, Kiffin's a young guy. I know he was born in 1975, so he's, 46? I mean, he's been around head coach of the Raiders, Tennessee, mm-hmm. USC, one of the schools in Florida.
Yeah.
And now Ole Miss beat LSU 31-17. But But he's a character, and word has it that he has an alias, Joey Freshwater, when he's out and about.
Boy.
His single guy, you know, out on the town, Joey Freshwater. You're okay with that?
I'm good with. I think that Lane has evolved. He's grown as a man. I follow him on Instagram and on Twitter. And let me tell you, he is a hoot. I mean, he has personality to boot. And I think that that would be well received, though. Like his personality and the way that he talks with his players and the way that he communicates would be a real benefit. I can see his personality meshing well at LSU.
Well, and a listener, actually a female, Darlene, says he was a Nick Saban reclamation project. He did get a job with Saban when no one else wanted to hire him, and Saban named him his offensive coordinator. Lane used to go around, and when he mentioned Saban, he'd have his hand down about a foot when he referred to Nick Saban.
Yep.
But they won a national title with Lane Kiffin on the sidelines at Alabama, and Saban's won a few with various offensive coordinators. What about Saban? Why not bring him back?
No, Nick Saban's not going to move. I am, and by the way, I am the biggest fan of his wife, Miss Terry. Miss Terry, to me, needs to be in the College Football Hall of Fame. She has been the architect at every stop that he has made in order to ensure that he has been successful and the program that he's leading has been successful. So, I mean, if we can get Miss Terry too, then I'm all for it.
I think that's a package deal, no doubt about it.
It is definitely a package deal.
And Saban at heart is a mercenary, and Scott Woodward, the AD, is the consummate big game hunter. So I think 10 years, $200 million would do it.
If he's got it in him. You think he's got it in him to do 10 more?
Well, he's already signed up for 7 more at Alabama.
That's true. That's
he turned
true.
70 on Halloween just a few days away. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Saban's a guy who takes good care of himself.
He does.
Like
he
I got saw the money this guy, James Franklin, who's mentioned.
Penn State.
Yeah, Penn State. And already 20 years younger than Saban, he's got a gut. We don't need that. That's a bad look for a coach.
Not what we're looking for. We need him young, fit, and still in shape.
Or old, fit.
As long as you're trusting the process and you're getting better every day.
Well, we're veering off on a topic, but there are only 5 coaches currently in college football who have won national titles.
Yeah.
Nick Saban, Dabo Sweeney, Ed Orgeron.
Yeah, that's one. Jimbo Fisher.
And Mac Brown. And 4 of the 5 coached at LSU. What about Jimbo?
I think we need to leave Jimbo in Aggieland. I think he's happy there. And I think I enjoy playing him every year. But I think we're good. I think Lane would be it would be a great hire.
Well, the fact that you have various interests, I'm sure that contributed to your comeback. You got this large support base. And even though you're out in the world, people know you. They respect you, admire you. When something like this happens, it makes you take heart. How much of a factor was your support base?
It was everything, especially because in a global pandemic, I couldn't have my friends next to me all the time. I couldn't have even some family members around. And so the support from our local community, from people all around the world, for not only me, but for other women that are going through this experience, it means everything. It is what empowers you to get up each and every day and continue to fight. And that's a battle that you've got to want to win in order to get there.
And a listener asked about follow-up. How often do you have to go back to be checked?
Yeah, so I go every 3 months for now, and then eventually we'll probably spread it out to 6. But it's just it's important that we continue surveillance in order to, you know, understand if anything is coming back. But it also gives me the opportunity to continue to talk about breast cancer awareness to other women. And through my awareness campaign, Day 18, we're really encouraging women to perform self-breast exams on the 18th day of each month, because 1 in 8 women will be diagnosed.
That's what you're wearing,
shirt that says. Yeah, that's my Day 18 shirt.
Day 18. Yeah.
So put the reminder in your phone, lock it in, and perform those self-breast exams. Encourage the women that you may know and love and friends and family to do the same.
Well, you have come back like a champ, and no doubt you fought it like a champ. But when you go in every 3 months, considering what you went through just a year and a half ago, I'm sure there's some consternation about...
Is it coming back?
Yeah, is it coming back?
Yeah. No, I think I do that every day. You wonder, you know, you got a headache and you're wondering, oh my God, has it spread to my brain? Or you've got your wrist is hurting or your ankle is hurting. There's an anxiety that's associated with it, which is why, you know, for your listeners and for those that are out there, if you know someone, especially in the month of October, if you know someone that has battled this disease, you know, have that empathy and the compassion to understand the battle's not over.
All right. Dana asks, are there survivors groups?
There are. Woman's Hospital has several groups that women can become a part of. There's also groups through Susan G. Komen, as well as Cancer Services of Baton Rouge as well.
So I suspect you're an ambassador, not only being on the board, but you have a crew of people who've been through something like you have.
Absolutely.
But every case is different. I always hate it when people say, I know how you feel. They don't know how a person feels. They know how they feel.
Exactly.
But they don't know how you feel or I feel.
And that's why it's so important to ask. And I always tell people, ask, how do you feel today? Yeah. How do you feel right now in this moment? Because that's what matters.
And even somebody as buoyant as you, you have good days and bad ones.
Oh, there's definitely bad days. There are days that I can't get out of bed. They exist.
Even now.
Oh, yeah. Even now. Because when you put your body through all of the treatments that I've been through, you do that.
Well, congratulations. And let's keep getting updates from Whitney Brough.
Sounds good.
You're an inspiration. We'll be back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And we switch gears just a bit. We're joined by a true Renaissance man, a guy with a past, George Valdez, and a fascinating gentleman, and calls Miami, Florida home, 877-217-5757. And George, you and I have a mutual friend in one Manuel Martinez. How did you meet the great tailor from Baton Rouge by way of Tampico, Mexico?
Manuel Martinez is not only a great tailor, but I really consider him a great friend. I met him about 20-some years ago. At that time, I was working with Congress, and I was doing youth rallies with members of Congress. And I was at an event in Washington that I think Louisiana was also there. And Manuel, I met him, and a friend introduced him to me. And being Hispanic, we connected right away. And he's been making all my clothes for the last 20-some odd year. And it's funny because, you know, when Manuel came on the robbery report, said Manuel Martinez will get you noticed. Well, when the Netflix special "Cocaine Cowboy Kings of Miami" came out, the suit that Manuel made for me began trending on Twitter, and it was like crazy. It's like, then I did a podcast for Netflix. You can't make this up. And the host, she tells the producer, she said, "Look, he's my favorite." And if he doesn't give me a book, I just want him to give me wardrobe trip advice, because he's dressed impeccable. But it's all due to Manuel. He's the one that makes my messed up 65-year-old body look good.
Now, you're Dr. George Valdez, correct?
Yes, sir. I have a PhD in New Testament and Ethics from Loyola University in Chicago.
And as I mentioned, you have had quite a varied background. Your family moved to Union City, New Jersey, born in Havana, 1956, boarded one of the last freedom flights from Cuba to Miami in 1966. And you've had this remarkable life of ups and downs, and you identify yourself as an ex-narco, ex-con. Now, what do you mean by being an ex-con?
Well, I don't know if I identify myself like that, but I am that. Ex-con means I was convicted. You know, my story, you know, when I did this Netflix, I ran from them for 3 years. I kept telling them no. Because the thing about it, I knew that people were glamorized that life, right? I mean, at the age of 21, I was making, this is 1977, I was making between $1 million and $3 million a month, you know. But the interesting thing about my life that was different than all those people. And this is what I kept telling the producers of Netflix. I said, look, I don't want to do this story because all your stories are the same. All these narco stories are the same. Poor kid, you know, drops out of school, joins a life of crime, makes a lot of money, becomes wealthy, lives a lavish lifestyle, kills people, ends up dead or in prison. That is not by no means my life. I was the youngest employee in the Federal Reserve Bank at the age of 17. I was a nerd. Literally, I didn't never drink alcohol, didn't do drugs. But one thing led to another, and I crossed the line that I said I never was, because I was so focused on succeeding. We came from Cuba, lost it all, and went hungry in America. And we came from a very wealthy family in Cuba. But my father had tremendous honor and principle. And I worked full-time for the Federal Reserve Bank and went to University of Miami full-time at night to get a degree in accounting. And then this professor asked me to go work for him. I did. I want to start my own practice. And the first client ended up being a grocery store that turned out to be a front for the group that became known as the Medellin Drug Cartel. And before you know it, I was in charge of all U.S. operations at the age of 21. And one thing led to the other. I was arrested in Panama, tortured, brought to the United States, charged with heading the largest drug conspiracy in the world, and went to trials, got convicted, sentenced, went to prison. And that roller coaster of a life.
All right. How long did you serve, George? How long were you in jail?
Well, I ended up serving 5 years the first time because they gave me the max they could, which at that time was 15. Now it would have been 3 life sentences. And then I served 5, came out, went back to the same thing for a short period of time. But I realized that the world had changed. When I first got started, we thought we were the Kennedys of the 21st century. Nobody used drugs. It was the rich and famous, and so that's how I justified it in my mind. But when I came out of prison in 85, now Pablo Escobar was there and it was violent. People were dying all over the place. And I walked away. I walked away and I was retired for 4 years. And then the government come and get me, took me to Jeff Sessions' office in Mobile, Alabama. They couldn't stand the fact that I had walked away with no investigation, no indictment, and I was living the life of a multimillionaire playboy. But, I just become a Christian. I just become a Christian literally a month before I got arrested.
All right. Well,
3 months before I got arrested.
You're on a roll, and what a life you have had, Dr. Valdez, and is the featured person, one of them, and one of the primary ones in the documentary Cocaine Cowboys, the Miami Kings. And he was involved in the Medellin cartel, and many of us in Baton Rouge remember that name from the Barry Seal days. Did you know him?
I did not know Barry Seal, but I did know the guy that killed Barry Seal, Miguel Velez, because I've been visiting Angola Penitentiary for 22 years. As a matter of fact, by God's grace, I think that the greatest achievement of my life was we were given the opportunity to build the Our Lady of Guadalupe Chapel, the only Catholic chapel inside a United States prison at Angola. So we built that, and until COVID, I have been going 22, 23 years in a row.
To see the guy who killed Barry Seal.
Yeah, I go there, minister to the inmates, and then visit him. I led him to the Lord, Miguel Velez. And then 3 years later, or 2 years after I led him to the Lord, he ended up painting the entire chapel, the altar, which is gorgeous. And then he caught cancer and did not want treatment. He felt that God forgiven him and ended up dying.
Well, and he killed Barry Seal. I think that was 1986. And you were intricately involved in a dangerous operation, but you say you were making $3 million a month. Did I hear you right?
Yeah, in 1977 money. So at that time, give you an idea, they say that in 1977, 78, the Federal Reserve Bank in Miami had more cash than all the Federal Reserve Banks combined.
And you were 21 years old at the time.
Yes, sir.
Making $3 million a month. Now, that's hard for anybody to say no to. But did you ever have any pangs of conscience? Like, my God, what am I doing for humanity? Go ahead.
That's the interesting thing that you said, Jim, because I wrote a blog and I said, I'm 21 years old. I make millions of dollars a month. I have mansions, jets, helicopter, yachts. I date the most beautiful woman in America, and I want to die every day. See, I was brought up by a very, very religious Catholic mother. Reason we left Cuba was because she didn't want us to grow up in a communist country that said God did not exist. And my mother did not know at the beginning, but when she found out, it devastated her. And then, when you get, first of all, this is the thing that I try to teach as I go around the world lecture. It's easy to cross a line and it's very difficult to not uncross it. And, you know, I said, for example, I'll use an example. My life, my first wife, when I cheated on her the first time, I couldn't sleep for, you know, for a week. The second time, I think I only missed sleep 2 days. After that, I didn't even miss sleep at all. And it's just like that. No one starts shooting an ounce of heroin. No one starts drinking a gallon of vodka. We build up to that. But why? Because this emptiness that we have inside, that we feel that these substances will go and you know, make us feel better. But they don't. It just makes you worse, and you go on a roller coaster, and you go from worse to worse to worse. And before you know it, you're just gone. And, I mean, I thank God that I was arrested, you know?
You've had a life of ups and downs, more ups than downs, and you've lived to talk about an experience that included a five-year prison hitch, and then he even went back to jail. And George is the featured person, one of them, in Cocaine Cowboys, The Kings of Miami from Netflix. How do you like the documentary?
You know, I thank God. I didn't want to do it for three years, Jim, because here's my pain with the doc. I think they did a great job in the sense of I've always conscious of the fact that we're living in a world that is sick, because people are enamored with narcos. And I think it's crazy, because there's nothing to like about that. But at the same time, like I told the producer, there's going to be a mother that's going to watch this documentary and say, listen, because the USOBs, I buried a child. There's going to be a young man or young woman who said, I grew up with my dad in prison, or I grew up without a dad. Mm-hmm. And that was very important for me to get them across that, sure, it's glamorous. Sure, you know, you're living this fast life. You got all these toys that people want, but there's pain and there's consequences. And the least thing I want is some 13-year-old kid dropping out of school and saying, I'm going to become George Valdez, because it is impossible. So I wanted them to stress, and I think they did it well, because as you see, besides me, it didn't end well for anybody, you know, and there was a lot of people that died. And, you know, it's tough, but I think that they did an amazing job, you know, because they showed the good and they showed the bad. And it's a real story. It's a Miami story. It's an immigrant story, you know, and it's just, like I said, at the end of the documentary, you saw episode, I said, look, it didn't have to end this way.
Well, the documentary is a Netflix production, Cocaine Cowboys, The Kings of Miami, and you'll find out even more about Dr. George Luis Valdez by way of Havana. He's made Miami his home, so had stint in prison, but has reformed and has a remarkable story. If there ever was a remarkable story, this is it to tell, and he's done so. Thank you, George. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And in a moment, we are slated to hear from Daniel DeVise, the biographer of B.B. King. Before we get there, though, Game 1 World Series last night, the Atlanta Braves defeated the Houston Astros in Houston 6-2. Braves are now get 1-0, 7-game series, as it always is. And Atlanta is looking for its first championship since 1995, and the Astros, of course, won a few years ago, their first title in the history of the franchise, which began in 1962 as the Colt 45s, but should be a good series, and we'll be talking about it. B.B. King, considered one of the most important artists of the blues ever, iconic careers spanning the golden age of modern blues, he forever altered the sound of American music, and yet, astonishingly, this musical and cultural legend has been without a full-length and authoritative biography until now. So we hope to hear from Daniel DeVise in short order, but he is making the rounds today. This is a big book from Simon & Schuster. So we are pleased that on the first day it is out, Daniel is slated to talk with us. But for those unfamiliar, B.B. King, born on a cotton plantation in Itabena, Mississippi, worked at a cotton gin in Indianola, Mississippi. He was attracted to music and the guitar and church, as many of his contemporaries were and are, and began work in juke joints and local radio, lived in Memphis, Chicago, toured the world, and died at the age of 89 in Las Vegas in 2015. And we do have Daniel with us. And Daniel, not so long ago, wrote a well-received book about the friendship of Andy Griffith and Don Knotts. And that's the last time he was with us. He is a Pulitzer Prize winner, graduate of Wesleyan and Northwestern, lives in Maryland, and he is a guy who has written prolifically about many topics and now has taken on the King of Blues, one B.B. King. And I'm sure this was a work of a great enlightenment for you, Daniel. He B.B. King, was truly an American legend. Daniel DeVise, do we have him? There we go. Let's see. While we're waiting for Daniel, Lalandra, let's give it for those who appreciate the music of B.B. King. He had, of course, a catalog of songs that are memorable. Used to perform more than 200 concerts per year into his 70s. And in 1956, when B.B. King was 31, he did 342 shows. Here is perhaps his most famous piece of work. Well, the thrill may be gone for B.B. King, but that song lives forever, as does his catalog of work, which was immense. And he's a guy who performed for decade after decade until he ended his life, or his life ended at the age of 89. He didn't end it. He died of natural causes, age 89, May 14th, 2015. Daniel DeVise, this young man in Mississippi, how did he become the legend that we know of today? Still got problems with Daniel, so we'll see if we can work it out. But I see that he's there, Alondra, so let's see if we can. Now, I think we do have him. Daniel, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. Tell us how B.B. King became B.B. King. It started in 1925. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, great to talk to you again. I think we talked about Andy Griffith and Don Knotts a few years ago, didn't we?
We sure did, yeah. I mentioned that. That was a great
book. Good to
be
on the air with
great
you again.
Book.
Thank you.
And I was commenting, this is a huge book, and it is the definitive and one of the few biographies, but this is the work about B.B. King, and that was the work about Andy and Don. And I still remember, I didn't know that Andy Griffith and Don Knotts had such an interesting and at times fractured friendship, but it ended amicably. But B.B. King is a guy who died 6 years ago. We're talking about him, and the biography's overdue. Tell us more.
Oh, well, I write about what I love, right? And I loved Andy Griffith and Don Knotts and their show, and I loved B.B. King. I grew up in Chicago, and I saw his kind of disciples, you know, in concert, people like Otis Rush and Sun Seals and Buddy Guy. And for this book, I wanted to sort of go on a journey of explaining why B.B. King matters so much, why he's so extremely important in our musical history. And that's really about connecting the dots back through time from your Albert Kings and your Buddy Guys, and for that matter, your David Gilmours and your Eric Claptons and your Billy Gibbons and your Princes back to B.B. King. I say in my book, and I think it's correct, that B.B. King basically created what became the go-to guitar sound for solo guitarists for like many, many years. And that sound is the sound of kind of a human voice expressed through a guitar. It's Lucille's sound. And that is B.B. King's genius, is that he had this idea, this notion of that I'm going to sing and then you're going to sing his guitar. And he named her Lucille, and he sort of projected his own singing voice into the guitar. And as odd as it sounds, I don't think anybody had really done that before.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did the listener ask, how did the guitar become known as Lucille?
Oh, there was this fire in Twist, Arkansas, maybe in 1949, maybe in 1950. I found an old radio interview with the fellow who owned the property where the fire, so we know for sure it happened. So, you know, B.B. King told this story very accurately, that the gig it went up in flames, basically, and B.B. ran back inside to get his guitar, and he found out that the woman who had started the fight, basically, it was like a love triangle or whatever, was named Lucille, and so he named his guitar Lucille. But here's the funny thing. His bandmates all knew of Lucille. Like, people who played with him and his wife, Sue, knew that he called his guitar Lucille, but nobody outside of that entourage was aware of that until the late 1960s. Lucille is finally named in print around 1967, and until then, she's this secret member of his band, I guess.
Well, he had a long, long career and performed in all the major cities, but he is a man of the South, and another man of the South who died in 1968 is mentioned more than a few times in the book, Dr. Martin Luther King. What was the connection with those two?
Well, this was all behind the scenes, but apparently B.B. King performed a number of times to sort of help the civil rights movement. He would play like fundraisers and play events and lend his support when he could, but always behind the scenes and in sort of an attitude of sort of modesty and humility. I didn't find a single article anywhere or an account in any book that mentioned this, but the people who were with him in the 60s told me that he did help the movement. So he and Dr. King knew each other. They would stay in the same hotels because they were, you know, segregated hotels. But I think from B.B. King's perspective in the 60s, he saw Dr. King as a massive figure, you know, like presidential, you know, as important in his way as like a pope or something, whereas he saw himself, B.B. King, as I'm just the humble blues man. So I don't think he saw himself as being on anywhere near the same level. And maybe that's partly why he just stayed in the background and just helped out where he could.
A listener, Tom on Blue Bonnet, asks if it's true, the story that B.B. King's favorite singer was none other than Frank Sinatra. Is that true?
Certainly one of his favorites. I think it bespeaks B.B. King's own ambition and also the breadth, the broadness of his tastes. He loved jazz. He loved blues. He loved rhythm and blues. He loved pop music. I think he even enjoyed Bob Wills, you know, mm-hmm. Ernest Tubb, you know. So he loved Sinatra. And it's so fitting because by the end, you know, B.B. King was at that same level of the Sinatras or the Arethas or the Louis Armstrongs or the Ellingtons of the world or the Elvises. I mean, maybe even, you know, huge, not just the king of the blues, but this incredibly important mm-hmm. performer and this iconic American. He gets the Medal of Freedom from George W. Bush in 2008, and he richly deserved it.
The book is The King of Blues, A Rise and Reign of B.B. King from Daniel DeVise. He died of diabetes and high blood pressure, but he lasted till he was 89. And did he have a send-off, Daniel? He was flown to Memphis, and the funeral procession went down Beale Street. Quite a presentation.
Yeah. He was honored in Las Vegas, which is where he'd lived for, gosh, since the 70s. And then a whole nother celebration that starts in Memphis and goes down, I think maybe even down Highway 61 to, and I just made this trip myself because I did all these live book events over the last few weeks all over Mississippi, and they wound up at the Namesake Museum, which is a lovely museum, which is in Indianola, Mississippi.
And unfortunately, hundreds of his recordings were reportedly destroyed in the 2008 Universal Fire, but the book tells it all about the King of Blues, B.B. King. Congratulations, Daniel DeVise. Thank you, sir.
Oh, thank you, sir. Thank you.
Our pleasure. And signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Stay safe and stay tuned.